Okay, so for those of you who weren't here last night, what we did was we went over step one, and what I asked is if anyone wanted to give a two-minute elevator speech. And what that means is if someone comes up to you after a meeting who's brand new, who says, I can't stick around, but I'm confused about what a compulsive overeater is, and I'm not sure if I should come back next week, how in 2 minutes could you describe the allergy of the body and the mental twist? What is a compulsive overeater? So is there anyone who did the assignment who's willing to do that and willing to be recorded? Come on up.
Hi, I'm Barbara. I'm a grateful compulsive overeater. I practiced this in my carpool coming here from my house this morning. So a compulsive overeater is someone who has an allergy of the body to certain substances and a mental obsession. So the allergy of the body, the physical craving, when we take it into our bodies, we begin to crave more. And as we all know, it's extremely impossible to stop without a higher power. And so we abstain from certain foods that trigger that allergy. And the mental obsession is that part of us that is obsessed with taking the first bite, with wanting to eat. And for both of those, we have the 12 steps, which is the solution. And we first put down the food so that we're not physically craving and we don't have the allergy going. And then we have to work on the mental obsession, for which the solution is the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, Overeaters Anonymous. We ask a sponsor to help us go through those steps, someone who's already recovered. And what else? And if you feel like you cannot control when, where, why, how much, or what you eat, and if you also feel like you can't stop when you want to stop, or you can't not start when you don't want to start, then join us on the Happy Road of Destiny.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Anyone else want to come up? That girl in red and the girl in green.
Good morning. I'm Nancy. I am a compulsive overeater. I'm a recovered compulsive overeater. When I was in the food, I was always fighting the food. I was always excitedly trying the next new diet that I had researched and decided it would be the answer for me. Feeling on top of the world when I could follow the diet and losing weight. Secure that I had finally found the solution and was now on top of the world. Then, shame filled with disgust at myself, that one more time I was face down in the food. This diet hadn't been the answer after all. I was running from myself, running from the knowledge that what if I couldn't figure it out? What if there wasn't a next diet? What if I had to surrender to being ever fatter? What if I had to give in to the fear of failure, fear of getting fatter and fatter? What if I had to acknowledge that I couldn't do it? Where would I go? My whole life was a house of cards, being held up by my will, my strength, my determination. What if I admitted defeat? Wouldn't everything come crashing down? Walking on that tightrope of desperation, that's my experience as a compulsive overeater. Oh, but what about God? I was a believer in God. Well, I prayed like crazy that God would help me stay on the next diet. Surely he wanted me to be healthy. God would help me. But it was all about me deciding what God would do. Today, God takes me by the hand and he leads me into peace and serenity. He leads me into a life of service. He leads me out of that desperation. He leads me out of always looking how to fix myself. I surrendered my desire to fix myself, and he does it. Thank you.
Thank you. And Liz?
Hi, I'm Liz T, a recovered compulsive overeater from Minnesota. And first of all, if I met a newcomer or someone struggling in my meeting, my character defect would be I'd want to take them hostage and keep talking to them. So I would have to ask my higher power for help to not be too overbearing, you know? But I would, first of all, if they would give me the privilege of a couple, 2 minutes with them, I would probably share something from my story, right? And I'm asking God that whole time, what can I say to help this person? It's not about me. So I might say something like, I tried dieting and the weight obsession on my own. I realized they were not the problem that I thought they were. I was using them as a solution. I was using food as a solution. And that baffled me for a while. I would remember Harlan saying that, the food is the solution. We've been using food as the solution. What does he mean, you know? But it took more of my own research to take that internally and concede to my innermost self what that meant. If I could hold them hostage for maybe one or two meetings after the meeting, I might take them to page 44 and say, it's we agnostics. We hope we have made clear the distinction between the compulsive overeater and the non-compulsive overeater, the real compulsive overeater versus the moderate and the temperate compulsive overeater. Which one am I? I need to know what I am and what I am not and who I can help and who I cannot. If you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely. Or if when eating, you have little control over the amount you take, you are probably a compulsive overeater. If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. And I remember, I also, if I can take them hostage or talk to them later in the week, I'd talk about this powerless diagram, the mental obsession and the triggering the allergy that I got from a fellow, and I'd be willing to share if you guys want copies, I can email them to you. But somehow I would wrap my story around that when I take the first compulsive bite and trigger the phenomenon of craving, I don't know how long that phenomenon of craving is going to take. I thought I could outsmart it, that I could white knuckle it, that I could have one cookie. I would believe that delusion, that lie. And it took many relapses for me to realize when I was in the phenomenon of craving. I don't know about you guys, but a head full of Big Book in a way and a belly full of food is about the most desperate place to be. So I would somehow wrap my story into that. I don't know. I would ask God into it in that moment. Up on a stage is a little harder than on one-on-one. But I would certainly offer up to them, hey, let's read doctor's opinion this week if you want to. Let's find a time that works. It takes about 30 to 45 minutes. And that's all I can do, you know, is plant that seed. That's been a big part of my recovery, is planting the seed and letting go. And I'm not taking people hostage, right? So with that, I'll pass.
Thanks, everyone. So I want to encourage people, we're going to stop now for time, but for those of you who did the assignment, maybe at lunch, share it with each other. If you know anyone who's new, we saw those people who have a couple days of abstinence, maybe ask them if you can share it with them. If you have a couple days of abstinence, maybe ask if you can share what your understanding is with a recovered person to have a beginning of some dialogue. So thanks, everyone, for doing the assignment. Okay, so we're gonna start out with the questions. For those of you who weren't here yesterday, we have an Ask It basket in the back for any questions, and we're gonna start out each session with questions. So we have quite a few, and thank you so much. It really helps me to have these questions, so I really appreciate people willing to do this. And actually, let me introduce myself. So my name is Kim Greik. I am a recovered compulsive overeater from South Jersey, and I've been recovered now for 7.5 years, but I've been in OA for 24 years, so you guys can do the math. And I'm just very grateful today that these 12 steps have become a way of life versus temporary respite that I experienced for the first 17 years. So the first question is, if I have to abstain from my trigger foods for the rest of my life, why don't I have to abstain from my trigger behaviors forever too? Why can I find a cure for behaviors mental but not foods physical? They're both chemical reactions to the body. I have to say I disagree with the premise that if you have a behavior that creates the phenomenon of craving, you do have to abstain from it for the rest of your life. But there's a difference between some things you might have to do while you're going through the 12 steps to support your abstinence that maybe isn't an allergic reaction. Like, for example, I'll give you one of mine. I binged a lot in my car because my mom's in OA, so I couldn't binge in the house the way I wanted to, because, of course, being that, once again, I lived at home until I was 27. Aren't my parents really, you know, lucky to have me living that long? So I had to abstain from that while I was going through the steps because it was so much of a psychological idea. I eat in my car a lot now. You know, if it's gorgeous out at work, I'll go eat in my car. If I'm going to an event and I want to eat before I go into the event, I eat in my car. So that was something I did to support my recovery. It wasn't something that was actually that created the phenomenon of craving. I'll give you another example, weighing and measuring. People always have a lot of opinions on that. There's certain people, I'm one of them, that a volume creates the phenomenon of craving in me. And because of that, it's a part of my abstinence. There's other people that weigh and measure because it supports their food plan and it helps them know how much they're eating. So they can maybe not always have to weigh and measure because it's just supporting their food plan. Does that make sense, how it can be different? I'll give you another example. One of my behaviors that creates a phenomenon of craving is grazing all day long. So I have to have a definite beginning and ending of each of my meals. So that's something I have to do the rest of my life. But there's other behaviors, like I didn't eat while I was watching television while I was going through the steps because I wasn't present of mind. I am a single woman, and I eat every dinner in my house on my couch watching TV. Because now that I'm recovered, that behavior isn't anything that is a problem. So I think there's a difference between what we do while we're in that recovery ICU of going through the steps to support our abstinence and what specifically creates the phenomenon of craving, which is once again why it's so important to go through that doctor's opinion and understand what the effect is, because then we can identify the effect in ingredients, in foods, and behaviors versus trying to copy what other people are doing. Does that make sense? Okay. Kim, tell us about red light and green light ingredients and behaviors and how do I get started. Red light, green light, yellow light is not Big Book. It's not Overeaters Anonymous. It was a technique, I think, that people developed to help identify foods. I personally use it, and I'm not going to be able to use it after I talk about this because I'm going to tell you the trick. Is I try to get people to write down everything they know they're going to binge on. There's no doubt in their mind. Then I have them write a list of everything they know they don't have a problem with, which is the green light. Then the yellow light foods are what are those foods that confuse them. There is no such thing as a yellow light food. It creates the phenomenon of craving or it doesn't. But what that does in the process as a recovered woman helping someone who's suffering is I help them look at their yellow light foods and we ferret it out. You know, is there something in there where you, like I said with the French fries last night, it was the ketchup, it wasn't the potatoes. And I couldn't see that because I cannot differentiate the true from the false. You know, if you're listing these foods, I mean, I hear people say all the time, well, I can eat it in a restaurant, but I can't eat it at home. That's not an allergy. People who are allergic to peanuts don't say, well, I'm going to have a peanut dish when I'm at a, you know, a Chinese restaurant, but I can't eat it at home. So what I use that technique for is so that we can ferret out what are your allergic foods. This is me specifically. I have them write at the end of the doctor's opinion what their abstinence is. Because then when they say, I'm not sure if I was abstinent or not, we go to that page. Now, what can happen is I'm so dependent on certain allergic foods that I'm not aware of other allergic foods or behaviors. And as I start to get clean of those major ones, I start to rely on other ones. And because I'm educated on the effect, I realize, oh, crap, I'm going to have to give up that. Now, what happens is the more you're into the step work, the easier it is to give up the other stuff. Does that make sense? Okay. Tell us more about how recovery message became watered down after treatment centers came out the 70s, 50s to 70s, and OA started in 1960. It was so fascinating. That was something I talked about. That is totally conjecture on my part. This is not, you know, but what I've heard in AA is the recovery centers have a language that started to permeate the rooms. The idea of an open discussion meeting was never there. In fact, I'm going to read the 1940s preamble. In the 1940s, AA the book and AA the fellowship were exactly the same. It was in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s that the fellowship and the book became to really divert. And just to think about it, we became into being around the time that these two, the fellowship and AA, started to divert. So if you want, I can give you some podcasts of people that talk about the history and things of that nature, but I don't want to waste too much time on that. I just think it's you know, I don't know about you, but like, I ate a lot of crappy diet food, but really what I wanted was Cinnabon. So what I want to say is that the big book is Cinnabon, and a lot of stuff we hear in the fellowship is the crappy diet food. So I want the real stuff. What suggestions do you have for dealing with fellows with mental illness and depression? I want to get this really clear. Nothing. We are not medical professionals. I have no opinion. We should not be telling people what to do when it comes to diabetes, high blood pressure, bipolar, depression. It is none of our business. My specialty is I'm a recovered compulsive overeater. I can help you with that. I cannot help you with anything else. And when it says no opinion on outside issues, that means positive or negative. There's no such thing as an OA nutritionist. You might have a nutritionist that works for you and you can recommend to people, but that is not an OA nutritionist. You might have a psychiatrist that has helped you with issues. That's wonderful. You can talk to people about it, but that is not an OA psychiatrist. So we have to be real clear on, you know, what we are carrying. We're carrying a message of the 12 steps. And it's not, we can hurt people. We could really hurt people if we start to tell people, you know what, you are not bipolar. You're a compulsive overeater. Stop taking your medicine. That's insane. That is absolutely insane. So I'm glad someone asked that question. And here's a sponsoring question. If when a person you go over the first step questions, you ask them if they are ready to put down the food and they say no, what do? I simply tell them when they're ready to put the food down to call me back. My thing is I don't want to give anyone the impression that the steps work while they're still eating, because then they think the steps don't work, as opposed to the steps don't work while they're still eating. So the way I think about it is I don't want to get between that person and their step one experience. That step one experience has to happen in totality before they're willing to do the work. We love each other to death in these rooms. What I want to do is give people information, let them have their step one experience, and then make sure that I'm available to have my hand out if and when they're ready. If they're not ready, there's nothing I can do. Now, I think the difference is a lot of times we say they're not ready. Is it really they're not ready, or they haven't heard the truth? There's a lot of meetings that give a lot of mixed messages about what compulsive overeating is, about what the 12 steps are. I know I was ready a lot of time, and I heard some crazy crap in the rooms of OA. So to me, there's this sacred moment where someone's ears and hearts are open to the message, and the person hears a clear message. So my job as a recovered woman is to make sure that my message is clear. I have no control over whether someone is ready. Does that make sense? Okay, so I'm going to start out with reading the OA, the AA 1940 preamble. Like I said, this is the time when the recovery rates in AA, in Cleveland, Ohio specifically, with Clarence Snyder, if you guys know the AA history, they had a 90% recovery rate. 90%. AA has about a 10%. I'm guessing we're a lot less than that. So what was going on? Listen to this preamble. They were clear about what they were carrying. So it says, we are gathered here because we are faced with the fact that we are powerless over alcohol and unable to do anything about it without the help of a power greater than ourselves. We feel that each person's religious views, if any, are his own affair. The simple purpose of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is to show what may be done to enlist the aid of a power greater than ourselves, regardless of what our individual conception of that power might be. In order to form a habit of depending upon and referring to all we do to that power, we must first apply ourselves with some diligence. By often repeating these acts, they become habitual, and the help rendered becomes natural to us. We have all come to know that as alcoholics, we are suffering from a serious illness for which medicine has no cure. Our condition may be the result of an allergy, which makes us different from other people. It has never been, by any treatment with which we are familiar, permanently cured. The only relief we have to offer is absolute abstinence, the second meaning of AA. There are no dues or fees. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. Each member squares his debt by helping others to recover. An Alcoholics Anonymous is an alcoholic who, through application and adherence to the AA program, has forsworn the use of any and all alcoholic beverages in any form. The moment he takes so much as one drop of beer, wine, spirits, or any other alcoholic beverage, he automatically loses all status as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. AA is not interested in sobering up drunks who are not sincere in their desire to remain sober for all time. Not being reformers, we offer our experience only to those who want it. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and on which we can join in harmonious action. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who will not or simply cannot give themselves to this simple program. Now, you may like this program, or you may not, but the fact remains, it works. It is our only chance to recover. There is a vast amount of fun in AA, in the AA fellowship. Some people might be shocked by the seeming worldliness and levity, but just underneath there lies a deadly earnestness and a full realization that we must put first things first. And with each of us, the first thing is our alcoholic problem. To drink is to die. Faith must work 24 hours a day in and through us, or we perish. In order to set our tone for this meeting, I ask that we bow our heads for a few moments in silent prayer and meditation. I wish to remind you that whatever is said at this meeting expresses our own individual opinion as of today and as of up to this moment. We do not speak for AA as a whole, and you are free to agree or disagree as you see fit. In fact, it is suggested that you pay no attention to anything which might not be reconciled with what is in the AA Big Book. If you don't have a Big Book, it's time you bought one. Read it. Study it, live with it, loan it, scatter it, and then learn from it what it means to be an AA. Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so we're going to be starting We Agnostics. If you were going to indulge me, I think I'm going to go an extra 5 minutes again just because of the time. I'll do my best to do this. Actually, one of the things I forgot to do yesterday, because one of the things you're going to hear me a lot of talking about is my own prejudices. And step two is all about prejudices. So let me tell you what the 12 steps of Overeaters Anonymous meant to me prior to studying the Big Book. So step one was, I'm fat and I don't want to be fat anymore. Or I'm not fat and I'm terrified of getting fat again. Step two was I was going to have to go back to the Catholic Church, Catholic faith, and do everything the Catholic Church told me. Step three was God was Santa Claus, and I'm going to give him a list of things he's supposed to do, turning my will over. And if he did everything I wanted to, I would allow that to happen. And if he didn't, I was going to take my will back. Step four was I was going to tell you what a victim I was. I was going to tell you all the nasty things that people did to me and why I have no choice but to eat. And my main goal was that the person I was going to give my fifth step to would hate these people as much as I did. Six and seven was I was going to have to lose my entire personality because I was not good enough. Eight and nine was I was going to have forgiveness from everybody, and people were going to have, I'm going to have people like me from now on. Step 10 was to make a list at night of all the dirty, nasty things that I did so I could beat myself up. Step 11 was I was going to have to go back to that Catholic church and start to like the priests and the nuns again. And step 12 was, even though my life is unmanageable, I'm going to become your diet coach and your life coach, and I'm going to manage your life. That was not the 12 steps that are in the big book. So what we're going to try to do today is we're going to learn what the big book is telling us about these steps. So step two is we agnostics, and once again, I'm a Catholic, so why read a chapter about agnosticism? Because I'm not agnostic. What I have found is I needed it more than atheists because I had so many prejudices. So even if you're comfortable with your higher power and you have a higher power that works for you, this chapter is important because you're not going to be sponsoring people that all have comfortability with their their higher power. So the origin of the word agnostics is Gnostic is knowledge and ag is without. So it's those without knowledge. Step two is not teaching us about God, telling us we have to believe in a God. It's trying to get us to concede. Do we need a power greater than ourselves? Has the powerlessness in step one convinced us that we need a power outside of ourselves to recover? And that's all that step two is trying to tell us. So I'm being confronted with what are all my prejudices? Because really, if step two, if the solution to my problem is a belief in God, and I can get there in step two, then we only would need a two-step program, right? The reason I need 12 steps is because I acknowledge I need a power greater than myself in step two, and I need the rest of the steps to get access to that power. So I'm not going to go over that first paragraph because Liz talked about the idea, you know, the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic, and I hope we made that really clear last night. So on page 44 at the end, it says, if a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, we would have recovered long ago. I could wish to be moral. I could wish to be philosophically comforted. I could will these things with all my might. The needed power was not there. Our human resources, as marshaled by the will, were not sufficient. They failed us utterly. A friend of mine in South Jersey says, you can always tell how sick she was by how many self-help books she has on her nightstand. I saw a meme on Facebook a while ago that said, I read 100 self-help books and continued to relapse. I read one help others book and I recovered. That is what this is about. So all this analysis in my head, I have to tell you, my undergraduate degree is a psychology degree. I think I did that to try to figure myself out. I had an abnormal psychology class and our assignment was to pick a disorder and write it in first person. I was a morbidly obese teen, you know, 19, 20-year-old who had a lot of friends that were bulimic, and I wrote it on bulimia, and I got an A+, and my teacher said it was like you were in the mind of a bulimic, and I didn't know how to express to her, but no, you don't understand, this is what I want to be when I grow up. This is what that story was about, because I wanted to figure myself out. That psychology degree did nothing for me. So that first paragraph on page 5, it says, lack of power. That is our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. So let's look at what it doesn't say. It doesn't say lack of intellect, lack of knowledge, lack of years in Overeaters Anonymous, lack of having the right sponsor, lack of having the perfect food plan. Lack of power is my dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live. It doesn't say we had to find a power by which we could eat. My problem, which we went over yesterday, is I cannot live sober comfortably. I have to find a way to live sober comfortably, and then I won't be drawn to find ease and comfort in something else. And I love how it says the word obviously. It's one whole sentence. And for those of you that came in this just today, maybe it's not obvious to you because you didn't have all the information before. The reason it's obvious on page 45 is because of page 44 and before. And that's why step one is so important. I was talking to someone at breakfast about this. We have four chapters on step one. That's how important step one is. It says, but where and how are we to find this power? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. The main object of this book is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself which will solve your problem. Main object of this book is not to help you stop eating. In fact, it never says in this book, maybe this will be the homework assignment, try to find in this book where it says don't drink. It never says that. What it says is, you're going to drink, you're going to drink, you're going to drink unless you have a spiritual experience. So the main object of this book is to get us to have a spiritual experience so we're not going to want to drink anymore. So let's go over to page 47 now. The last line on page 47. It says, besides the seeming inability to accept much on faith, we often found ourselves handicapped by obstinacy, sensitiveness, and unreasoning prejudice. Many of us have been so touchy that even a casual reference to spiritual things made us bristle with antagonism. This sort of thinking had to be abandoned. I'm telling you, not only I love the big book, but I also love Webster's Dictionary because I have a lot of prejudice about what I think words mean. So that word handicapped, a condition that markedly restricts one's ability to function. So what is inhibiting my ability to function? My obstinacy. That's my, I know. I've been through these 12 steps. I know what OA is about. I know God. If knowing God or a belief in God was enough, then why are there nuns, priests, rabbis, imams, spiritual teachers that are in 12-step programs? That are in 12-step programs. I was told to speak slower. I'm sorry, I'm Jersey. I'm going to try to speak slower. That this is not about a belief in God. It's about access to power. I need access to power. Obstinacy, there's a Sandy B is one of my favorite AA speakers. And one of the things he said which blew my mind was, it's not what we don't know that will kill us, but what we know for sure that isn't true that will kill us. It is that old ideas that are killing me. My sensitiveness. I mean, God, I take everything personally. You know, there are people in North and South Carolina that are suffering a hurricane right now. But my thought was, it better not delay my plane. That hurricane's trying to get me, so I'm not going to make it to Denver on time. Like, that's the arrogance that I think. I'm so sensitive. I think the whole world is about me. My mother said in high school, if she ever tried to talk to me about my weight, I screamed or I cried. There was no way to talk to me about it. And then my unreasoning prejudice. I had a prejudice about the word prejudice. Because I thought, you know, that, well, I have no problem with African Americans or gay people, or I'm a Democrat, but I don't have a problem with Republicans. Like, it's like, that's what I thought prejudice was. No. What they're saying is any prejudgments that we have about anybody. What are my prejudgments? I just told you my prejudgments of the 12 steps that kept me in bondage to the food. What are my prejudgments about Overeaters Anonymous? What are my prejudgments about religion? Do I think that Christianity is better than Judaism, which is better than Muslimism? Do I think those people in OA who are atheists and agnostics, they're below me because I actually have a relationship with a specific God? Those are all prejudices. You know, I remember in I have like a, you know, a coffee mug like this at work. And I went to lift it up one day and threw it in the air because I thought I had gotten my tea and I didn't. So my prejudice was it was going to be heavier. And because I thought of that, it flew in the air. That's all a prejudice is. I mean, one of the things I wrote in my journal as I was going through the step is, God, help me to be teachable. God, help me to be teachable. Because if I'm not teachable, I'm not going to be able to get my way through this program. So it says here, some of us resisted, though we found... Oh, I'm sorry, last one. This sort of thinking had to be abandoned. Pay attention to the absolute language in the big book. It doesn't say reconsidered, tweaked. Maybe on the weekends you can kind of, you know, do this, and on the weekdays you can do what you want. This sort of thinking had to be abandoned. So it says, though some of us resisted, we've had no great difficulty in casting aside such feelings. Faced with alcoholic destruction, we soon became as open-minded on spiritual matters as we tried to be on other questions. In this respect, alcohol was the great persuader. It finally beat us into a state of reasonableness. That's exactly why I realize I cannot get between someone and their first step experience. The food is what's going to convince somebody. So I often use this example with this, is how readily I accept other things. I have to tell you, one of the most difficult things with this retreat here is I have no sense of direction. I feel like I need a seeing eye dog, like to go around and see everything, because I had, where's Mary? Someone help me go. Yeah, she got helped me get here today because I could not go from the dining room to here. Everything looks the same. I come out of an elevator in a hotel and I'm like, I don't know, right, left, who knows? I have no sense of direction. I didn't leave Burlington County, New Jersey until I was like 25, 26 years old. And the reason I left it at that point was because of a GPS. And when those machines happened, it opened up my world. Now, I just put this machine and put an address in there. I felt no need to call the company and say, could you tell me where those satellites are? I want to know where those satellites are. I want to know the name of the engineers that developed it. I want to check out their credentials. Let me see the patent. It was my need for my powerlessness over lack of direction that made me say, let me try it. And every time I got from point A to point B, I started to trust the machine every more. Every time it said recalculating route and I would let it happen, I started to trust the machine more. That's what we're asking you to do. You know, don't fake it till you make it. Just be willing to do something different. I love how someone said, my recovery began when I went from yeah, but to yes, ma'am. Am I willing to follow direction today? The same way with the GPS. And just as a little side note, the God of my understanding at when I recovered 7.5 years ago is not sufficient at 7 years. It has to continue to grow. I heard a speaker say recently, not a God of my understanding, a God of my experience. And I am so lucky because now I have a God of my experience. It's gone beyond understanding. So the same way with the GPS. I now have a GPS that has a social media aspect on it that when I'm going someplace, I turn it on while I'm eating dinner and it tells me how much traffic it is to go. And I have to tell you, I went to this 15-week series in Philadelphia. I think I went a different route every single time I went into Philly because it took me by whatever the directions were. And I trusted it and I got there. I become more trusting with my higher power every day. When that app a couple weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, said, we have a new feature, do you want it? I hit yes. I didn't even know what the feature was. And the feature was it hooked up with my calendar. So now on my phone it pops up, you have yoga in a half hour. Traffic is light. It'll take you 18 minutes. I'm like, oh, thank you, phone. So am I letting my relationship with my higher power grow as I'm recovering? As I'm a recovered woman, that's what that is telling me. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay. So let's go to, where are you at? All right. So I'm going to say one more thing. So we're going to go to 5 after. We'll take our 10-minute break, and then I'm going to actually combine 2 and 3 for the next session, okay? Because I really want to get into page these bedevilments, and then we'll go, once you're done the bedevilments, we'll go on. So the bedevilments are on page 52. So these bedevilments, if they only plagued me when I was in the food, once again, my solution would be abstinence. So what someone challenged me to do was to read these bedevilments in first person and say when abstinent. And if they were true for me in abstinence, then I was going to have to find another solution than abstinence. So that second paragraph, second full paragraph on page 52, I had to ask myself why I shouldn't apply to my human problems the same readiness to change my point of view. Was I having trouble with personal relationships when abstinent? Couldn't I control my emotional nature when abstinent? Was I a prey to misery and depression when abstinent? Couldn't I make a living when abstinent? Did I have a feeling of uselessness when abstinent? Was I full of fear when abstinent? Was I unhappy when abstinent? Couldn't I seem to be of real help to other people when abstinent? Now, my personal experience is the food is a really, really good anesthetic. So what I saw from my own experience was my real problem was these bedevilments popped up when I stopped eating. And the only way I knew how to get rid of the bedevilments was to eat again. And I had to look at it. Once again, could I not make a living? I always had a job. Once again, I'm living with my parents when I'm 27 years old. When I was abstinent, people wanted to throw candy bars at me to shut me the hell up. I was so angry. I couldn't handle it. So if these bedevilments, once again, if you're 30 days, 60 days abstinent and you're not working the steps, think about it. These bedevilments are that is why we eat. And I'm going to need to find access to a power greater than myself that are going to relieve me of these bedevilments so I don't have to go back to the only other solution I knew, which was to deaden. I ate to feel better in the beginning. I ate to feel nothing towards the end. Great numbing agent. I'm embarrassed sometimes when I go, I had a grade school reunion. I don't even remember. Like, I don't remember high school. I don't remember college. I was numb. I can tell you how much I weighed every year, but I really can't tell you any of my teachers' names. I have no idea.